Hi, welcome to Invisible Illnesses, episode 5. I'm Steve Ward-Booth, and just a reminder that whilst I am a practicing GP and Dr. Tony Davies in this episode is a pain specialist, none of the information given here can be specific to you, and if you have concerns about your own health, you should seek your own assessment with a qualified clinician. So welcome back, it's Steve here. Alex and I are very lucky to have a fantastic guest today. I'd like to introduce Dr. Tony Davies. Tony's main role has been as one of the lead consultants in Plymouth's chronic pain clinic, with a background, as is usual for this specialty, as an anaesthetist. He also has a degree in psychology and huge clinical experience through a long career, from which he's recently but not completely retired. Within chronic pain, he's been particularly interested in fibromyalgia syndrome and allied conditions characterised by central sensitisation. And as well as being a full-time clinician, he has published academic research which has pushed forward the understanding and the way that we help people with these kinds of condition. He's got an international reputation for his work in this area, perhaps most notably his role in designing and rolling out the body reprogramming, which is a course or a concept and a way of understanding and managing symptoms with these illnesses. And on a personal level, he's been something of an inspiration to me. So it's great to have you. Welcome, Tony. And Alex, do you want to fire away?
Yeah, excellent. So, hey, Tony, really nice to meet you, and thanks so much for joining us on the show. So, I think the kind of it's having kind of looked through all the stuff that you've done and you've worked on. It's where do we start, I suppose, in a way. But one of the things that I think is really important is this concept of body reprogramming, which I think is I guess what you're most known for. So should we start there? Like, could you tell us a little bit about what does body reprogramming mean and how we would use that?
Okay, well, it's probably worthwhile setting the context a little insofar as my background as a pain consultant has largely been in fibromyalgia and a very common disease. I suppose as a Welshman, I've always supported the underdog. And people with this sort of condition, I would say, when it comes to contact with healthcare professionals, very much they seem to be having a challenging time. So during my work in chronic pain, I realized that these groups of patients, so these are with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome as well, they come under an umbrella of functional illnesses. And if you explain functional illnesses, it's essentially those conditions where there's no clear anatomical, physiological cause to them. And so in that respect, you need somehow to get a connect between the patient and their experiences and also your knowledge as a doctor and finding some way of integrating both directions. And so as a result of this, I realized that there was a huge gap in terms of what we did as doctors to help patients or people with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and similar conditions. To be frank with you, I think each speciality has the same patients, but it depends on what the predominant symptom is as to which service they see. And of course, pain is one of those symptoms which perhaps is one of the greatest sort of existential threat. And so more people will actually see doctors because of generalized pain. So if we look at fibromyalgia, there's only a few things that we need to sort out. The definition, the diagnosis, the cause, and give an explanation for that, and also what is best treatment. So there really is a huge need to try and conquer this and move forward for the benefit of those who have these conditions. And so I was lucky enough to meet a theoretical professor called Professor Hyland, who worked in Plymouth, who had chronic fatigue syndrome most of his life. And when I met up with him, I realized that our direction of travel and understanding of these conditions was very similar. And so having probed his theoretical understanding, I thought, well, I can use his model, his theory, to try and organize our therapeutic approach. And this is where body reprogramming came out. I think part of it as well, you wanted a description which didn't, as so often is the case with people with these conditions, some healthcare professionals said, well, this is all in the mind. This this is something which I think the most disappointing story that I had from a patient was when they said that their healthcare professional had said, well, what you have is SHIT, life syndrome. You just need to learn to live with it. And so really quite disappointing to hear that. Very disappointing indeed.
Sorry, just to interrupt you on that one, because I think that there's something around the conversations you had with, going back to the way you met with Professor Hyland around that. It seems important to me that almost the way you interacted is important, that you were talking on a professional to professional basis almost.
Yes.
So when you were hearing, you know, when you were interacting about his particular experiences, you were meeting on that level, whereas what you just described there with the patient and the doctor is very much a kind of almost a bit judgmental. It's the doctor up here, you down here as the patient, and you talked about the underdog. Is that important, do you think, to understand that dynamic in terms of how we move forward on this?
Yeah, absolutely. If you were to ask me what the most important change for me in the art of the consultation, which is a critically important part between a patient and a doctor, is essentially that we are treated as equals, that it is a dialogue, that it's not some sort of paternalistic sort of consultation. And so in that respect, it's a case that it is adult to adult rather than a parent to a child, which historically has often been the case. And further to that also, I think it would be fair to say that there historically has been a fair bit of arrogance in medicine. We are the experts. And certainly, if there is something that we don't understand, it is very easy to then conceptualize your conversation that somehow the patient is at fault. Because as doctors, it makes us feel better. And it then overcomes that position of, I don't know what is going on here. And I think one of the things, having been involved in the medical school background, is it's so important for doctors to learn how best to manage uncertainty. Now, Steve, you want to pop in and say something here?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I think there's two things that have just come out together that just made me think that. One is, you know, when you spoke to Michael Hyland, who's come from a completely different professional background to you, and then you find you've got these similar ideas, observations and concepts, it's incredibly vindicating, reinforcing, it's fascinating. And that's been the constant experience that I've had. You and I come from different training backgrounds. My understanding was all experiential. Very little of it was, certainly initially, was academic or taught. And when you get these meetings, it's very, very powerful. And I just wonder if one of the differences that we observe now, when we go back to, I used the term maverick earlier, when you would go back 20 years, we're looking at patients who only have the option of this biomedical model, and this other information isn't in the domain, and it's no wonder you get this mismatch in understanding. And I think that now, when I have these conversations far more often, the patient has the experience that you and I had, you had when you spoke to Michael, or I have when I speak to you, or various other professionals, or a psychologist, for example, who's working a different domain, where they're saying, actually, this matches my experience. This matches what's happened to me. And that's a very powerful thing to happen in a consultation. So a lot of it is about putting some information out there that allows a patient to then, you know, make their own decision about what fits best. And, you know, have I got a structural disease in my elbow, my shoulder, my head, my knee, my gut, my uterus, and they're all separate diseases, or have I got one unifying thing which fits better? And of course, the latter starts to make sense. So I wonder if again, it's another example of the parallels between, you know, we're all humans and we think about things in very similar ways, and we've constructed a divide very artificially through medical education. But I've digressed us there. So, yeah. And part of, I guess, what you've achieved with body reprogramming is a way of bringing those mindsets, those different models that patients might be arriving with, in line with the medical model, finding a middle ground, something that's acceptable to both sides of this and makes sense to everybody.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with all of that, Steve. It has been particularly challenging because on the one hand, I have my biomedical model. On the other hand, you've got the person's lived-in experience. And I look at the two and I'm thinking, it's really don't match at all, because the patient wants, for me, one of my favorite quotes, I don't know if you watched the series House, American medical series House, and Hugh Laurie at one point there goes, better a murder than a misdiagnosis, you know, and it's very much a case, it's all in the diagnosis, you listen to the symptoms, then you do your examination, then your lab findings and imaging, and then you've got the perfect diagnosis. But the difficulty you have with some of these conditions is that, for instance, another situation with a patient came back to me on one occasion and said, oh, I don't think I need to see you again. I've seen the orthopedic surgeon and he's sending me for an MRI. What I've got is I've got a disc bulge which is pressing on my spinal cord, and once he sorts out, he'd be able to get an operation done and I'd be fixed. And I said, well, what we'll do, I'll give you an open appointment so you can come back if needed. 4 months later, the patient was back. I said, so what happened? Well, I went in to see the orthopedic surgeon, really excited. And do you know what? He wouldn't even look me in the eye. I said, well, what? He said, oh, the MRI is normal. There's nothing wrong with you. And the patient said, I left that room afterwards feeling it was my fault. I felt abandoned. Mm-hmm. And so this is the challenge that you have. And of course, the patient has followed and taken a different journey and a reasonably successful journey since then with a different diagnosis. But it just shows the model that we got at times does not work when it comes to these much more complex conditions, such as fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome. And it brings me to mind an analogy that we often use in body reprogramming, which is thinking of hardware problems and software problems. Yeah. So what do I mean by that? So hardware problems are largely components in a computer, the same as in a body, which you can break. So you break a leg, you can get fixed. You sometimes need to change components like hip replacements or knee replacements. It's a bit like in a computer, if your disk drive wears out, because in my case, it wore out because I was listening to too much Barry Manilow music. So you sometimes need to replace certain components, or otherwise you've got underpowered, overpowered parts of the system, a bit like somebody with hypothyroidism, you need to give thyroxine, or overpowered where you've got hypothyroidism. And it's the same in the situation is the doctors love working with hardware problems, fixing components, changing components, tweaking components. But most of the problems you have with the computer are software. And it's the same with these conditions. So what do I mean by that? I'm talking about the operating system. It's the communication between all the systems in our body. And those systems can be biological ones, your hematological, your neurological, immune, metabolic, autonomic. You've also got psychological systems, those related to drive, to threat, to soothing the system, etc. But there is no one bit that can get fixed. It's the communication between all those systems. The brain is part of that, but the software is distributed completely around the body within all these different systems. And the brain is part of it. But what I do not like is the euphemism of software, meaning pertaining to mental health problems exclusively. For me, the software is the communication through all systems in the body.
And we've got good evidence for that, Tony, haven't we, in terms of things like the commonest functional disorders like irritable bowel syndrome, where there's certain studies that you can demonstrate where psychological state clearly influences it. But there are also studies you can do that demonstrate that receptor activity within guts, with the muscle, the nerve receptors and their interaction with the gut muscle is disordered, and that the signals that are being sent from the gut to the brain are different. And it's a great example of a system-wide problem.
So you need to incorporate the psychological components as well as the biological. And if you look at most of the models to explain these conditions, they're either one or the other. And one of my least favorite is that it's all mental distress being manifested as somatic symptoms. You know, you can't test that, so that's not helpful, and it often results in quite fractious consultations. But you do need both, and it's an integration of both, because you have multiple systems, and doctors generally want to look at one system at a time. But body reprogramming, looking at Michael's model, it's very much the way that all these systems integrate and network and communicate together. They do not work independently. So for many of these conditions, unfortunately, I don't think you're going to find one bit that can be fixed or replaced or repowered or reduced in power. And that's the challenge. I wish we could. And one of the questions I ask the patients in the group setting in body reprogramming, how do you fix a software problem? And so one of the answers is, on a computer, they say, oh, turn it on and off. Well, I wouldn't last long with the GNC if I was adopting that strategy. However, it has been trialed. They've actually done ketamine comas in the past, put somebody in a ketamine coma. So that has been done for certain chronic pain problems in the past. But what you have to do, you have to put new information into that system to try, a bit like a computer patch when you're talking about computers, to try and modify the way that operating system works. And that then potentially can help move things forward. And that's why in society today, I think it's so important to focus on well-being programs. For me, some of these community centers which have been closed down, I'm going, that's not good. That's not good. What we need is more of this, not to wait until somebody is so severe in their symptomology that they now have to see a medical specialist, but to try and look at this earlier and to see this as a societal problem, because these conditions are not binary. It's not like having an infection. I have an infection or I don't have an infection. These are spectrum. You can have mild, moderate, severe, and you can keep moving. So, Alex, I believe you've got a question as well.
I do. No, it's fascinating stuff. And I just wanted to kind of delve into that a bit more, because I think our listeners would be really interested in that. When you understand that, and I think as a layperson, it makes complete sense to me. You know, and I think there's, as an aside, I think there's a lot. You know, that what I was reading about, you know, body reprogramming. You talk about kind of stop programs, and that really kind of, it was a bit of a light bulb moment for me, because the complexity of the system is always there. It's just you don't notice it until something goes wrong. And so could you kind of help understand for our listeners, like, so when you do take this approach and it seems very sensible and very logical, what does that mean in practical terms? So you talked about that kind of work, you know, what's the patch that you just described? What does that kind of look like in practical terms for someone who's having these kind of symptoms?
I think it comes to two fundamental components of the model, and one is stop signals and the other is stop programs. And stop signals, one of the questions I'm often asked, how do I explain the problem that I have when I have fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome? So stop signals are essentially the system, the body's intelligent. And there are times where it says, I'm now under threat, or there is a challenge, I need to stop routine activity. So what happens is it puts the brake on, and that brake is done by sets of symptoms. So pain is one, fatigue, dizziness, nausea, sensitivity. So it will say, do you know what? I need time now to deal with it. So think of getting flu, major flu. Basically, you have to stop for a week, 2 weeks, whilst the body then focuses on that, which potentially could, if you think of flu or COVID, for instance, it's an existential threat. So it needs to put all its resources to sort that. But then when it's dealt with it, the system comes back to a default position. But if I can make an analogy here, the difficulty, and especially in modern society, is we often don't listen to our bodies. So for instance, if you were talking to me, Alex, and I wasn't listening to you, what you're going to do with your voice is you're going to start talking louder.
Eventually, yeah.
And eventually shout to me to keep my attention or to get my attention. But in modern society, we're very good at suppressing this, you know, dampening that, overriding it. No, I'm too busy here. Yeah, I'll deal with that later, for instance. And so the body will shout louder. But the difficulty that we have is in acute stresses, our bodies are great at dealing with that, at adapting. But when we have sustained stresses, be they physical, be they psychological, over sustained periods of time, there is a challenge. And sometimes what can happen is that it cannot adapt, it cannot maintain stability, and that system can get reset. And that, for me, is what I see in patients with these conditions. And if it gets overridden further, these systems can get, the brake can go on more and more and more, and the symptom presentation becomes severer. So the key is to be aware of this earlier, so you can help reset. So one of the key things is when you get flu, et cetera, take time to recover. You know, when there are stresses, be it work stresses, for instance, you need to get that downtime to get that balance. So the system can say, yep, this now is less of a threat, less of a challenge. I can reset back to my default position. If you don't over time, the problem is that the system, and in medicine, we use the term allostasis. So homeostasis is basic, normal default. Allostasis is where the load is so great over a sustained period, you can get an allostatic state, which is where you reset at a different level. So what does that mean? You might well be far more sensitized to even normal stimuli. People who will go into supermarkets, for instance, with dark glasses on, because that fluorescent light actually hurts the person. You know, it is painful to be in that environment. And that is the challenge that you have. As things get more severe, that system can reset in a different place, which is possibly more sensitized to threats, to other situations, be they physical, be they psychological. And so it is key to be aware of that earlier. So that is, for me, what the practical significance is, you know, listening to the body and being aware of the way that the body responds.
Okay. And so where's your, you know, in that kind of reset analogy, which is, you know, makes complete sense. It's almost like, as human beings, we're so adaptable. We can adapt to anything, even something that isn't a kind of an outcome that we want. Where is the kind of path back to health from there? Is it kind of, what advice would you be giving to kind of work through that? I know it's not a simple solution, but in general terms.
I think first and foremost, it's the narrative, it's the explanation. In my clinic, one of the nurses told me, if you want to really annoy Dr. Davis, steal his handkerchiefs. Because if a patient sort of tells the story and you're explaining it, often patients will get tearful and say, this makes so much sense. And so in that respect, it's important that the person has the narrative, the understanding, because it is so important that the person who has the condition is empowered, that they are key to any journey that is being taken, and not passive recipient of specialist doctors saying, do A, do B, do C, do D, but they are key components of the recovery process as equal members of the team. So that is...
And within that becomes some of the challenge as well, doesn't it, Tony? Because we were thinking about the guest that we had previously, who was fascinating, very, very intelligent, very successful guy who ended up with a lot of different symptoms. And he ended up actually getting a long way down the line through private health cover a diagnosis of an obscure yes. kind of tick-borne disease that we don't see in the UK that he picked up in Europe. But the interesting thing about him was that rather than just saying, as I know many of my patients might have done, will say, oh, well, that is all to do with the tick. Yes. It's this yes. biomedical problem. Yes. He felt it didn't add up. There was other stuff going on that, yes. that made more sense to him. And he kind of did his own research and found his own yes. ways through and his own ways through. Again, it's this thing coming from a completely different place, but ending up with the same kinds yes. of solutions. And the kind of solutions he's come up with are, you know, have great similarities between what you would recommend on a body reprogramming course. But many patients, I would say Kieran is quite unusual like that. And many patients, because of the way we've been brought up and conditioned to look for a very neat biomedical explanation, can be on varying degrees of resistance to that concept. And because in many ways we can assume it's nice to have ownership and understanding, if you feel quite helpless, if you feel like you've never really been able to control much in your life, then it can be much more challenging to be handed back that that yes. baton, if you like, yes. that locus of control. Yes. And I guess that's what we sometimes meet where it's makes it more difficult to help people.
Absolutely, Steve, absolutely. And this comes back to one of the approaches that we took. Do you do this on an individual level or a group level? Because doing it in a group is more efficient from a health resource perspective. But also there's the power of the group. Many of those who are invited to the groups, the first thing is, whoa, I don't want to do this in a group, thinking that they will have even less control within that setting. And it's interesting because I often go along to the first session of these groups and the third session. The first is the introduction and describing the model. The third is more with medication. And the first one, everybody's so quiet and nervous. By the third session, do you know what? You can't stop them talking because they feel they're in a safe environment. And that social contact, that awareness, I'm not alone here, is so, so powerful. And that encourages what you've been describing there, the empowerment, the sense of being in control. To start off with, there's this feeling, and I often say, this is why those with fibromyalgia, we say the diagnosis and the management in primary care, because once the patients come into secondary care, often the specialist would think of that one main symptom and then see the others and go, I don't know how to deal with those. So the patient can often be like a ball in a pinball machine going from one specialist service to another. And for me, where we as doctors have done harm is where we have given the patient a list of different diagnoses, six or seven of them, where there's far more overlap than differences in those conditions. So for instance, a patient with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, POTS syndrome, mast activation, mast cell activation syndrome, Ehlers-Danlos, hypermobility, et cetera, and I'm thinking we have caused harm there. Because the poor patient is there saying, what chance do I have now? Look at the number of conditions I have. But when you look at them, there is more commonality than difference there. So again, what we say and what we do as doctors is so, so important. But we need the person who has lived that experience to be a key active component in terms of understanding, in terms of the direction of travel for rehabilitation. Steve.
So Tony, I'm so glad you brought up the kind of group versus individual, because one of the things I was gonna ask you was, do you think that there is something specific from the group that adds value
to the process of body reprogramming compared with doing it on a one-to-one? Because you could meet with these patients and explain the concepts and give them a plan on a one-to-one basis. But do you think there's additional power from hearing other people's experiences, and telling your experiences to other people who've got lived experience?
Certainly, much of the feedback is, it was great to realize I was not alone. I mean, that is so common. However, it does need to be nuanced, because it's interesting at the moment. There's one group, which is an online group that I'm involved with later today. And four of the people haven't got their cameras on for the online program. And I'm thinking, there's a challenge here, because you're losing potentially some of that benefit. You're behind the wall still here, sort of excluding yourself to a large extent. So for me, a key component of body reprogramming is this sense of safeness in the world. It's a case of, do you know what? I feel comfortable here, I feel safe. And if you've got a group of others around with a similar framework, and I think one of the things that I say about those with fibromyalgia, and I do mention, you do see certain qualities in those with the condition. Okay, it's a bit of an overgeneralization, but generally I tend to find, and this is the irony, because common parlance, the stigma is people with fibromyalgia are just lazy. And I'm going, no. The only people that probably don't get fibromyalgia are lazy people, because they're not driving the system to reset this because of the pressures they put on themselves, etc. And in fact, an amusing story is that Michael Hyland and myself, at the start of our journey, put on the web, lazy people don't get chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia. It was not long afterwards that I was hauled into the chief exec office, and Michael had to go and speak to the vice principal, because somebody in the House of Lords, who saw themselves as a protector of those with these conditions, had written and said, what are your professionals doing here, etc., because they thought that we were poking fun at it rather than actually trying to move forward. So so it was interesting, and my chief exec, when she said, no, more than happy with this, but you know, try to avoid such publicity was the guidance.
Tony, I wonder if you could, because we haven't got an enormous amount of time left on this occasion, what can you tell us a little bit about your outcomes? Because, I mean, one of the things that you, you know, that's been amazing about your career is that you are published, you've demonstrated benefit. And could you perhaps just give us a little summary of the effectiveness of body reprogramming and similar interventions?
I think the first thing to say is that it's still waiting to get an NIHR grant to do sort of randomized control trials. So what we've done at the moment is what we normally do, our standard outcome measures for our programs. So our pain management programs. So it's a service evaluation rather than a control study, the quantitative data. So I want to put that out there. But these are the outcome measures that we've used in our more generic pain management programs. So they look at the general severity of the fibromyalgia, impact on mood, on anxiety, and quality of life. And what's been interesting is that the retention in the program has been very, very good, because most group programs with fibromyalgia, if you look at the feedback, is that there's no clear evidence that groups are beneficial in fibromyalgia. And the reason for that is often they're more generic groups with other forms of chronic pain. And before starting body reprogramming, I actually looked at the outcomes there. And in 3 years in the pain management program, only 12 people had completed the program with fibromyalgia. They were selected out, or they failed to continue because they found it too demanding physically, psychologically. So that's the reason we brought a unified approach. So the service evaluation, the difficulty is also getting people to fill forms, because people with fibromyalgia find it exhausting to do the course. Completing a set of forms they really do not want to do. So the data wasn't complete, but certainly there was strong evidence that there was clinically important differences and improvements in the overall fibromyalgia, to the extent that a severe to moderate, or very severe to severe, so a shift in terms of improvement, also in terms of mood improving, because many of the group programs, if somebody has a moderate depression, they would say, no, best not to join a group. However, we had very much an open recruitment. So as long as there was an active treatment for the depressive illness at the time, we were very happy to take those who had comorbidities and found that the level of depression improved, the level of anxiety improved, and the quality of life improved. So it certainly reinvigorated those who undertake the programs. It's positive, but it is not a controlled study. And in fact, we're looking at an NIHR grant, a government grant for this. The difficulty is when you've got busy jobs, it's trying to do the research as well. And as you know yourself, yeah, Steve, you're doing that as part of your off time, your leisure time. That can be quite challenging. But certainly what it has done is continue to invigorate us that there is evidence that people move forward. And certainly at the end of the course, the feedback the facilitators share, and you know, that's universally positive. Apart from one thing, Alex, which you mentioned previously, and that is supporters, people that they live with are not invited onto the course at the moment. And the feedback is, I want my significant other to hear this as well. And in fact, we're now looking to see whether we add an extra session, because people with fibromyalgia do not live in isolation. They live in an environment with significant others. And bringing along, I think, is important. To date, because of the number of sessions, even getting this introduced was a challenge. And I had to use every skill I could, including discussion with the chief exec, to actually be able to introduce this program. Because, you know, it was a change. It was a development. So in that respect, the evidence has been, I think, sufficient to say we need to continue this. But there is an Achilles heel. The further somebody goes from that particular group, the more likely, because of the environments they live in, of fading back to the way they behaved previously. So how do you sustain change, behavioral change in the longer term? And that really is the major challenge that we all have as healthcare professionals, you know, dealing with these conditions.
I was going to say that reflecting on that, I think it's really important, because there's a lot in there. And I know you guys talk about randomized control trials all the time, but for those people who are listening, I think stepping back from that, what I'm hearing is, you know, yes, there is more to be done, and there is kind of greater scale to put behind this. But what I'm hearing is, by actually kind of taking this approach, what you're saying is, not only are you kind of measurably making the ingoing condition, bringing improvements to the ingoing condition, but you're actually improving all the things around that. So the kind of feeling of mood, retention, just doing something and sticking with it for a group like this is a really major achievement. So, you know, I really applaud you for doing that, and recognize that this is a journey, not just for the patients in your program and for you as the owner of the program, but for us as a society to start thinking about this and taking this stuff seriously. And what Steve and I hope that we can do with, in some small way with this podcast, is get that conversation on people's radar of, you know, yes, this might, you know, this might just seem like a very niche and specialist thing, but actually it affects more people than you could ever imagine. And the benefits are much bigger than you could imagine. But we do need to take that change of approach. You need to think long term. You need to think extensively. You need to think of the ecosystem that sits around that individual. It's not a simple, quick fix. And as Steve said, we are kind of running out on time. And what I was going to say, just, and Steve, I know you wanted to come in, a couple of things for me is, One is that we will put all of the kind of relevant papers from your that you've kind of referenced in here onto the links of the podcast. So if people want to find out more about it, but it would be great, you know, if we could have you back at some point to kind of talk about more of the stuff. Would you be happy to kind of come along and have another chat with us?
More than happy to do so, Alex. I have to say this is a little less stressful than the experience I had on one occasion where I was invited. It was the Faculty of Pain Medicine said, Tony, do you mind going on to Woman's Hour with Jane Garvey?
Okay.
And I was it.
See, I told you we were getting a proper celebrity.
That is big news, yeah.
And I have to say, as the only male, she's no longer doing Woman's Hour, but boy, was she intimidating. And I had to do it in the BBC studios in Plymouth. And when I walked in, the first thing that happened in the soundproof room is that the light exploded. And I thought, this is telling me, walk away now.
There's a stop signal, I think, isn't there, Tony? Right there, yeah.
So thank you very much for your time, folks.
Great, and thanks for, because I think there's so many little threads there would be great to pick up on and explore further, and I look forward to doing so.
Thank you.
So nice to meet you, Tony. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tony.